October edition of Men of the Covenant. Glad you're here. Let me open us with a word of prayer. Father, thank you so much for your kindness. Thank you so much for the food that is before us. You have provided for us yet again, and it reminds us of every good and delightful gift that we've already had from you today and that we'll have from you this afternoon and this evening before we lay our heads on our pillows again. Thank you for your kindness, your generosity, your faithfulness to us. This food is a gift in itself and a token and reminder of every good and perfect gift that we've enjoyed from your hand today. So we give you thanks for those. Bless our speaker as he focuses our attention on your greater gifts, the gift of your grace. Bless him and use him and give him clarity of words and give our hearts clarity and unstop our ears so that we might hear and open our eyes that we might see. We make our prayer in Jesus' name and for his sake. And all God's people said, Amen. Thank you. Let me read something from Psalm 107. Guys, there are a couple of open tables over here, as well as there are a few seats scattered around, so there's plenty of room. From Psalm 107, verses 1, 2, and 3, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever. Let the redeemed of the Lord say so, whom he has redeemed from trouble, from the east and from the west, from the north and from the south. Jimmy Moore is a son of this church. Many of you watched him grow up, grow to manhood. You've watched as he and Finney, his wife, have raised their four children here. Most of you know, or many of you know, that his is a compelling story and a testimony to the rich and the searching grace of God. But let's remind ourselves, as Jimmy prepares to come share his story with us, that compelling stories are gritty stories. Compelling stories often make us uncomfortable. And we often come to a moment in hearing a compelling story where we say, oh, I wish he hadn't said that. But as the psalmist said, redemption comes to those in trouble. And that's what we hear about today. The sweet grace of God coming to a man who found himself in trouble. We've all found ourselves in trouble. We hear that story today, compelling, and gritty, and uncomfortable as it can be. It causes us to see how great and kind and good God is to folks, to sinners, broken like us. Jimmy, come talk to us, brother.
Thank you, Bill. You need some water?
I got it. All right. Is this?
It's on.
Are we recording?
We are recording.
Oh, great. Great. Okay. Perfect.
You're hot and it's for posterity.
Oh, goodness. Okay. Listen, fellas, it's great to be here today. I tell you, looking out, I'm struck with a couple of thoughts. One, clearly the state health department has shut down the fair food stuff because there's a lot more people here than I thought. And the second thought is I have to share a comment that that Dr. Elkin just shared with me. And I told him, thanks for being here. And he said, are you kidding me? He said, I wouldn't miss this for the world. He said, I love watching people strip off all their clothes and run down the street naked. So here we go. My name's Jimmy, and I'm an alcoholic. Actually, to say that I'm an alcoholic is just kind of part of who I am. Because I'm also a husband, I'm a father, a struggling father. I'm a reasonably compassionate GYN oncologist, and I'm a sinner saved by the grace of God. But I'm an alcoholic, and this is my story. It's a story that's really God's story. It's a story that's full of grace. It's a story that's full of redemption and reconciliation. It's an incredible story. It's a story about how God just loves to show His mercy and His providence in the absolute craziest of ways. It's a story that I can tell you has a happy ending. In 2 Corinthians, Paul talks about this affliction that he suffered in Asia. And he said it burdened him beyond his strength to the point of being despaired of life itself. Paul goes on to say that this burden of his was to make him rely not on himself, but on God who raises the dead. And he says, God delivered us and will deliver us. Now, I'll tell you guys, I can relate to what Paul is talking about here. There are a lot of crazy things, a lot of cool things about a sovereign God, a God who is in absolute control of everything. One of those cool things is that it came as no surprise to God in 2010 when I realized that I was an alcoholic. God, it seemed, wanted to teach me some things, and I'm just really thankful that I hung on for the ride. It's been an incredible ride. You know, they tell me that if you're ever driving through the country and you see a turtle perched on top of a fence post, that you can be sure that that turtle has had plenty of help. And I'm here to tell you that the same can be true if you see an alcoholic who's sober and genuinely happy. And I've had a lot of help in the last 4 years. A lot of you guys are here today that have helped me, and I am deeply, deeply thankful. But before I really get to the meat of my story, we have to understand that alcoholism and addiction, by their very nature, are gritty. Like Billy said, they're at times ugly. They're at times uncomfortable and hard to talk about. Believe me, it's hard to talk about. You know, addiction is a disease that has a lot of different flavors. Scientists would tell you that somewhere between 15 and 20% of the American population has an addiction of some sort. For me, that was alcohol. For other people, it might be prescription drugs or street drugs. There's some people that struggle with what we call process addictions, where they're addicted to things, gambling, shopping, sex, and things like that. You know, the statistics are overwhelming, and the statistics are sobering. They say that about 5% of the American population has a problem with alcohol. You know, in 2010, the number of accidental overdoses from prescription pain drugs or from drugs that are bought on the street quadrupled in this country. There were 17,000 deaths in 2010 from accidental drug overdose. In fact, in 2008, accidental drug overdose overtook other accidents as the number one killer of Americans between the ages of 25 and 54. This disease of addiction is a deadly disease. Alcoholism is a beast. It destroys relationships, careers, families. It destroys lives. Alcoholism just chews up people and spits them out like rubbish. And I got to tell you, before 2010, I had a completely different take, a different view on alcoholism. If you'd asked me back in the day, I would tell you that alcoholics live under a bridge. They push everything they own around in a shopping cart. But I'm here to tell you that there's a different face of alcoholism and addiction that's out there. Heck, it might be sitting right beside you next time you're at a family reunion or next to you on a pew in the church, even a church like this. Addiction is a curious disease, and I think it is a disease, and there's pretty good science to back that up. It usually has a real quiet, slow start. I mean, come on. Nobody wakes up one day, or at least I know I didn't, and said, you know what, I'm going to change what I do, and I'm gonna destroy my life with alcohol or with drugs. Nobody does that. But this disease, they say, is cunning and baffling and oh so powerful. Every alcoholic will tell you that at some point when they cross that line into alcoholism, they know and understand what people call the hideous four horsemen: terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Too many times, I think we as a culture look at an alcoholic or an addict as somebody who's just made some really poor moral choices. Now, don't get me wrong, sin plays a role in this disease. But we think, a lot of us think, and I know I did, think that, boy, if he would just get his act together and just quit drinking, everything is going to work out. But one of the things that I'm going to help you understand today is that on my own, I was not strong enough to do that. And there's a solution to this whole thing. And that's kind of what I want to focus on today. But just remember that alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control their drinking. Now, the crazy thing is that the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that he can drink like normal men. Many follow that path into the gates of death or insanity. Now, my story starts back a lot, probably like a lot of you men here in this room. I grew up in this church. In a lot of ways, I think my parents raised me in an extremely godly home. My dad and my mom absolutely modeled temperance in our house when it came to alcohol. I have no memories of ever seeing my dad out of control because of drinking. Somehow, psychologists will tell you that alcoholics drink for some reason. There's something back in their past that they're angry at or they're drinking at it. And I'm going to tell you, I've been sober for 3.5 years. And I've given this a lot of thought. You know, what in the world? Why did I do that? And you know, I honestly don't know. And I don't know that it really matters because where I'm at right now, it doesn't matter why things happened in the past. But it's a mystery that I don't think I'll ever solve. Early on in life, I learned that performance made me feel good. Okay, and so when I did well, whether it was on a test or in any other endeavor, it made something in my heart feel good about Jimmy. As I grew up and got into my 30s, I discovered that alcohol kind of helped me when I didn't feel good about myself. Now, it wasn't a conscious decision. I didn't say, wow, let's do that. But it happened. And that's a real common theme when you talk to alcoholics is that there's something that alcohol helps. And I'm going to tell y'all, it worked for me for a while. When I was in my 30s, I was a normal, regular drinker. I would sit back at night and watch Sports Center and have a scotch, and all the world seemed good. Families were good. Relationships were good. And then as I got into my 40s, that's an age that, you know, for a lot of people, the wheels kind of start to come off. Relationships broken. Unmet expectations. Financial struggles. Struggles at work. And there were some things in my life that happened like that. And lo and behold, I found myself drinking more. And it got to the point where that one scotch during Sports Center would turn into two or three or six. And without any kind of purpose, I found myself way out of control late at night with my drinking. I would drink. I'll tell you, I would drink until I basically passed out in my study. And that's probably where our paths diverge a little bit, okay? Because something happened in me, and I could not control how much I drank or when I stopped. I can control when I started, but I really couldn't control when I stopped. Now, all of that was one of those little secrets that nobody knew about. I thought nobody knew about. But turns out Finney was on to me. And there were times in my early 40s where Finney and I would be alone in a car or walking or something. And she would turn to me and she would say, "Jimmy, your drinking is out of control. You need to do something about it. You've got to change." It sounded good to me. I knew there was a problem. And I was always one of those guys, maybe you've met them before, and I said, "You know, you're right, and I'm going to change." Okay? But I was also one of those guys that change I was planning in a couple of weeks. Okay? And it never got around to it. But the real business here with my alcoholism was that I could not stop drinking. Now, I wasn't drinking at work. I wasn't drinking in the daytime. But at night, when everybody went to sleep, that's when I had my secret compulsion, was at night. You know, part of that compulsion takes a lot of energy. I think back 5-10 years ago, going on a trip was a lot of work for me, because I would physically take scotch and dump it into water bottles, kind of like that, because I didn't want anything to clank in my luggage, and I didn't want to get to wherever we were going and not have that scotch in case I needed it. Okay? Now, the unmanageability of this disease is incredible. That I feel like I'm a reasonably smart guy, and yet somehow I was compelled to do that because I didn't want to get somewhere and there not be any alcohol there. You know, there were other crazy things. I mean, just crazy things that I would do. Back in the day, I kept my liquor in the hunting closet. And I was the only person that knew where the key was hidden to the hunting closet. So I knew the kids weren't getting into it, and I was pretty sure Finney wasn't going to know how many bottles were empty. But it takes a lot of work just to try to empty, to take those empty bottles just to the trash can. I would wait until Finney was asleep or she was gone, and I would take bottles and I would put them in the trash can, just at the bottom of the trash can, covering them up like shame. And I didn't want them to clank. I think my overwhelming fear would be that I would drive home from work and the dog would have tumped over the garbage can and ripped open the bag, and there would be liquor bottles all over the front yard, and I could just see my neighbors kind of gawking at the reality that their neighbor was an alcoholic. It scared me to death. You know, was I really thinking that the garbage men were going to be on to me? I mean, that's insane. I'll tell you something else that was insane is that when I would buy scotch or whatever, I had automatic false stories made up in my mind that I could tell you if I bumped into you. Okay, if I saw you in the liquor store, I knew I would say, "Well, it's my week to restock the bar at hunting camp," or "It's my turn at the Grove to do this." I had all these lies that were built up that I was ready to share to make Jimmy feel okay, to make me feel fine. You know, a functional alcoholic is somebody that drinks alcoholically but still kind of holds it together enough in the world of life to keep going without a whole lot of consequences. And I lived in that phase for a number of years where I was basically a functional alcoholic. So I traveled on with my secret problem. It was interrupted only occasionally, three or four times a year, with confrontations with the woman that I love more than anybody in the world. I continued to work at a job that I just absolutely loved. I poured my life into my kids. And on the surface, everything looked good and calm. But I'm going to tell you what, under the surface, there was a riptide of a current going through my heart. And that riptide was shame. Okay? At night, I would say, well, I'm going to change. I'm just going to have one drink out of that bottle, that new bottle of scotch tonight. The next thing I know, it's 24 hours later, I look in the hunting cabinet and there's half a bottle left. And I just am overwhelmed with a sense of shame. Now, the crazy thing is that before that night's over, I finished it there. I kept doing it. You know, people say that alcoholism and addiction, it's like you're a boxer and you're getting into the ring with Muhammad Ali and he's just nailing you and you're taking his jabs. And then the round is over and you go back to the corner and then you get back in the ring. And that's what I did for a while. I got back in that ring. But you know, something crazy happened in my life in January of 2010. I remember it like it was yesterday. Finney and I were on a walk. We were walking around the block or something, and she turned and she had that same kind of talk about how my drinking was out of control. And she said, "Jimmy, you need to do something about it, but I'm doing something about it too." She said, I'm going to go talk to a counselor, have an appointment tomorrow, and I hope that you'll do that too. Well, I did. I got to be, some counseling sessions went on. I came to really love the psychologist that I was seeing. And initially, I wasn't there because I was an alcoholic. I was there because I might have a drinking problem. The counselor that we met with, that was the first person other than my wife that I had ever talked about my drinking to. I mean, nobody. None of my friends, nobody. But very soon I had help. The day after Finney talked to me then, I had text messages from my brothers. And they were out of the blue text messages. You know, "Hey man, we need to talk. Hey, Jimmy, call me. There's something I want to talk to you about." Now, Bill and Buffkin and I were friends. We were brothers. We were close. But just because of parents or being parents and the busyness of life, we had grown kind of apart. And it was odd that I got one text from them saying, "Hey, we need to get together." It was doubly odd when I got another one. But these guys came to my side. During that time in early 2010, Buffkin and Bill and I would ride around once or twice a week and talk. And to me, it seemed like all of the talk was focused on me and my drinking problem. They kept telling me when we would be together, they said, "Look, man, we love you no matter what." And, you know, I was so scared about that "what." I didn't know what that "no matter what" was. To be honest with you, I don't know what it is today. But I know that the Moore boys have my back. And that meant the world to me in a really dark time in my life. Now, it wasn't long when we were sitting there that Bill and Buffkin came up with the idea of, we need to tell Mom and Dad about this. And I'll be honest with y'all. Dad is here today. and that was probably one of the top 10 most uncomfortable things I have ever done. I'll never forget. I made an excuse to go over to Mom and Dad's, plopped in the kitchen. It seemed like the conversation was ending. And I kind of said, and by the way, you know, there's something I want to tell you. I think I might have a drinking problem. Now, Mom and Dad, great people. Mom hit her knees, I think, immediately in prayer. And that was important for me. Dad, the Marine, knew the importance of knowing your enemy. And before the day was up, he already had books on alcoholism. Before the week was up, they were tattered and torn and highlighted and everything else. The engineer came out, but so did the prayer warrior. You know, in that time when I was trying to process through this drinking problem, one thing that was curiously missing in my life, I never thought about Alcoholics Anonymous. I never thought about going and finding somebody who was an alcoholic in recovery and seemed to have things together. I never thought about going and talking to somebody like that. Well, that was a critical mistake. I'll tell you, in March of that year, that's March of 2010, my program began to stop drinking. In February of that year, I was nervous that if I just quit drinking, just boom, that I'd have a seizure or something. And I think that was my disease telling me that, okay? It was saying, you don't need to quit, come on. In February of that year, the deal that we worked out with my psychologist was that I was going to have one drink a day, okay, one drink a day. And that was smart because I had one drink that Finney could see and I didn't have to hide it. We were all cool with that. But that also drove me deeper into alcoholism, okay? Because I had one drink that month that Finney knew about, one drink that night that Finney knew about. But I had booze hidden all over my house. So that trying to stop drinking drove me, I think, deeper into alcoholism. Well, in March of that year, that was what I call my go-live date. March the 1st, I was no longer drinking. And on the surface, that is exactly the truth. I was no longer drinking, but I was secretly drinking at night. I spent a lot of time in the storage room in the early part of March of 2010. Finney, one Saturday, it was the Saturday before spring break of that year, and Finney was gone to a wedding. We had a spring break trip planned. We were leaving Sunday morning, and I looked up and I'm alone in my house. Had no kids, not on call, fixing to be on vacation. I thought, you know, this would be a good time to have a couple of drinks, and so I did. Well, Finney could tell that I'd been drinking when she got home. And all of a sudden, this whole thing just flew into existence, it seemed. We decided right then and there that I needed help. And we had to go get some help. My brothers were around. Bufkin was out of town. And we decided that day that tomorrow I was going to go to a place in Hattiesburg to quit drinking. And we did. I went to a place called Pine Grove. I went down for the detox thing. That's kind of hard to say in a minute of the covenant, that detox thing. But I went down to Hattiesburg. I'll never forget, Bill drove me. Somehow Finney had the strength to round up the kids and go on the beach trip that we had planned. Bill drove me. It was a great hour and a half drive. And as we were getting close to the treatment center, Bill said, I think I'm going to pray for us. And I said, that sounds great. So Bill is in the middle of this just eloquent prayer and beseeching and all this kind of stuff. And I looked up and we're pulling into the parking lot and this huge sign says, this is a tobacco-free facility. Well, I was drinking a lot, but I also was very much addicted to smokeless tobacco. And I was packed to the gills with Copenhagen that day. And I said, Bill, time out, man. We got to turn around. And Bill said, Jimmy, he said, nobody told me either. He said, I'm sure they just mean cigarettes. So we went back to praying. And I'll tell you, that before the hour was up, they had confiscated every can of dip and my stuff. So I was there for 4 days, and the internet said it's about a 4 to 7 day thing, and I think my wife thought more like 7 days would be a good idea. And but after 4 days, I met with my addictionologist, and he said, "Man, you're good, you can go, you're good." And I said, "All right." Now, he also said, "Look, you may want to think about, you know, some sort of longer term solution to this problem." I said, "Nope, I got it, man. I'm slick. I got it. I don't have time for any kind of treatment. I'll make it do. I'll wing it if I have to. I am good. I have stopped drinking." That was another critical mistake in my story. So I got out after 4 days, and I made it to the parking lot, found my phone, start calling for a ride because Bill had brought me down there. So I called Bufkin. He's at work. Finney's at the beach, or I thought. Bill's at work, way too busy to do anything. And so I called Dad. And I thought, you know, he's retired. This will be fine. We can do this. So I called Dad. I said, "Hey, Dad, you know, I'm out. And everything's great. And I just need a ride home. It's an hour and a half here, hour and a half back. Just need a ride home." And Dad said, "Well, you know, Shug and I have people coming over to eat tonight, and the pool is just a wreck, and I've got to clean out the pool." And I'm going, "You've got to be kidding me. I mean, I've done this wonderful thing for our family. I've stopped drinking, finally, and you won't even come get..." So I said, "Dad, look, no biggie. I'll get a taxi to take me to the bus station. I'll get a bus to take me to Jackson. We are good. Don't worry about me." And about 5 minutes later, my phone goes off, and Dad had called the nurse's station, and they had just decided that I was honorably discharged, and we were heading home. Now, I'm going to tell you something. That is a very difficult ride, to be alone in the car with your dad, the man you look up to more than anybody in the world, coming home from rehab. That's a tough ride. I'm not sure how we made it, but we did. I'll never forget, we're getting close to the stack. We're getting close to Jackson, and Dad says, "Well, Jimmy, where do you think we ought to go? Where do you want to go?" And I said, "Home. Home sounds good." And Dad kind of looked at me, and he said, "You know, I don't think that's a real good idea right now. I think Finney's kind of angry maybe and still processing through things. And why don't you come stay with us for a couple of days?" And I said, "Come on, Dad. I'm 45 years old. I can go home." So he dropped me off at home, and it was not a good homecoming, I'll be honest. I was expecting the Ole Miss band and the cheerleaders and dignitaries right there and confetti going off because I had done this great thing for our family. But I wasn't it. I got home and there was a duffel bag packed and a lot of tears. And so I went to our cabin at Lake Cavalier and spent a couple of days. And I'm going to tell you what, if that's just not a good spot for an alcoholic to be in. I came home and I was so selfish. And, on the way to the lake house, exactly where I stopped off. I stopped off at the liquor store. That's how pitiful and incomprehensible the demoralization was. So I spent some time at the lake that week. And on the surface, I had told Finney that everything was fine. But it really wasn't fine. I was drinking a little bit more. I was by myself. I was drinking during the day now. thankfully and mercifully, that period of my alcoholism did not last very long. Friday of that week, Finney and I decided we're all going to have everybody out to the lake. We're going to cook burgers, get ready for turkey hunting the next morning, and we're going to get our family together. Well, about 4:30 or 5, I'm sitting around the lake thinking, you know, drink would really help settle the nerves with everybody coming over, and I did. I drank that day, and Finney could tell when she got there. And then the most amazing thing happened, y'all. Out of nowhere, these people appeared, okay? My brothers, it was almost like they had been in ghillie suits in the woods next door. They showed up. Some of my friends showed up. And next thing I know, Bill has my addictionologist on the cell phone arranging treatment and this kind of stuff. This thing continued. We got home, and my small group leader from the church here came and sat on the sofa and talked to me. A couple of guys that I really respected from work came and said, look, you got to do the right thing. Because you see, I needed treatment. I needed it. I really needed it. And so on March the 21st of 2010, I went back to Hattiesburg to a 90-day inpatient treatment. You know, rehab like that is a crazy place. It's not exactly what I would call a hotbed of mental health, but it's a great place. It's a place of incredible growth. My first roommate there was a FedEx pilot from Memphis. Used to fly B-52s. My second roommate was a neurosurgeon from the Mayo Clinic. And being there, I realized that, first of all, I'm not the only person that's ever been down this particularly rocky path. Okay, there are other people that have been there. During those 90 days, I learned a lot about alcoholism. I learned a lot about addiction. I learned a lot about being rigorously honest, about not just saying things, but really meaning things. You know, the crazy thing in that rehab experience is that God took what initially I thought was the worst thing ever, okay, whether it was alcoholism or rehab or whatever. It was the worst chapter in my life. And God took it and He used it in a very, very, very special way. But you know, isn't that just like God? I mean, we shouldn't be surprised by that. I remember that part in Genesis where Joseph is with his brothers, and you know, they did all those things to him, and at the end of Genesis, in Genesis 50, he says, "You guys meant this for evil, but God meant this for good." Now, I kind of paraphrase that, and in my mind, I thought this alcoholism was evil. I thought it was bad, but God meant it for good. I'll tell you, the second homecoming from Hattiesburg was a much better homecoming. I was 90 days. I was embraced in this thing that we call sobriety. And this coming home was not just Finney and me and the boys and Lucy. It was our whole family. Our whole family went through this thing together, and after this deal, we're just so much closer than we've ever been. I'll never forget the very first Sunday I came back to church here after rehab. I was nervous as a cat, because I figure everybody knew what was going on with me and why I hadn't been here for 3 months. And I just knew that I would get all kind of funny looks and things. But I'm going to tell you what, guys, I had more hugs that day than I have ever, ever had. The people that I was most worried about that day, it turns out they were the most loving people I've that's the one of the best things I've ever experienced. Now, some of you guys may wonder, how does somebody get sober. And when I say sober, I mean totally abstinent sober, like not drinking at all. How does that happen? Well, I think that clearly there can be supernatural God interventions that get people sober. I know some people like that just get sober on their own. But I'm going to tell you something else. Alcoholics Anonymous is probably the best way of getting sober that we have. You know, I go to probably 4 or 5 AA meetings a week. I've embraced this program. I've tried to embrace recovery. And AA meetings are a special place, you know. They're a room with people, men and women, with a common problem and a common solution. They're men and women that are broken. They're men and women that realize that they've got a problem that needs attention. You know, real recovery like that leads to humbleness and gratitude. The meetings that I go to, Bill Moore says, are a lot like what the church ought to be like. A room of people that are looking for a solution, of people that realize their brokenness. You know, getting sober like this story is really simple. I mean, all you got to do is not drink that day. That's all I have to do. I don't know about tomorrow, but for today, as long as I don't stop off anywhere on the way home, I'm going to make it another day sober. But getting sober is also very, very hard. It's simple, but it's very hard. You know, early on in sobriety, I really struggled around people. I struggled around people. I struggled around places where people were drinking. It was really hard. But something absolutely crazy happened to me about 6 months into this deal. And God took that compulsion to drink and just lifted it off my shoulders. And so now, I don't really think about drinking. I've got these eyes that can see what would happen if I kicked back with the guys after work and had a couple of beers. Because for me, for this alcoholic, I couldn't stop at a couple of beers. And I'm scared I wouldn't be able to stop. You know, another kind of crazy thing that God does to me every now and then is I have a drinking dream. I wake up at night, in the middle of the night, in a cold sweat, my heart's going about a gazillion, and I've been dreaming that I'm drinking again. And I wake up and I hit the pillows and I realize it's a dream, and I think, man, thank goodness. I've got a good friend that says that these dreams like that are there for a purpose. And he said one purpose is to pretty much make sure that you understand that, Jimmy, you were not misdiagnosed when they said you were an alcoholic. This is the real deal. You know, as we finish up, I'm going to tell you, I have found an incredible recovery community in Jackson. Not just at AA meetings, but just all around. There are people that are in recovery that you know that you probably don't know they're in recovery unless you're really, really good friends with them. I'll never forget first time I would see people at an AA meeting and I would look and I'd say, you too? You too? You too? I can't believe it. But you know, me too may be the most powerful words in the human language. When you're struggling and somebody looks at you and says, you know what? Me too. I struggle just like that. I found recovery even in this church house. I found people that I go to church with that are in recovery. In fact, we have a group that's kind of like an AA group that we meet once a month. There's a blurb that runs in the first epistle. There's announcements in the bulletin. And if you ever look at that announcement, I want you to look. There's no time and there's no date for that meeting. And that is absolutely on purpose, okay? Because this group that we have is all about safety. And safety for an alcoholic involves anonymity, okay? We don't we don't want anybody else knowing really when this meeting is or where. We don't want people sneaking around the parking lot to find out who's coming to this meeting. We want this meeting to be open to anybody that thinks they might have a problem. And it's really kind of cool. We have somewhere between 6 and 15 or 20 people once a month that get together in this church and talk about problems with alcoholism and drug addiction. It's been an incredible ministry. Sometimes people come just because they're thinking that maybe they've got a drinking problem and want to figure out what to do about it. But I'll share one story quickly. The first time we met, there was a woman that came to that meeting, and she is 82 years old. And she's been a member of this church for way longer than I've been alive. She's been an alcoholic for 40 years. She came to that meeting, and when she walked through the doors, she was weeping with joy. Okay? Weeping with joy. Because she had gone to that same room for Sunday school for 35 or 40 years and had never, ever been able to open up and tell people about what she struggled with on the inside. But there in that meeting, she was able to do that. Okay, she was able to be real. That's that authenticity and realness that we all crave. You know, when that blurb runs in the first epistle and there's a telephone number to call, it's a real person that answers. You don't have to tell anybody your name. You just say, I've got a problem, I want to talk to you about it. Most of the calls that come through are not from at what I call SOS calls, with people saying, man, I need help getting sober. I need some help. Most of the calls are not that. Most of the calls are from family members wanting to talk about a wife or a husband or a dad or a son that's in trouble. And we've got a new meeting now that's at this church that's just for family members. And if you ever have an inkling to want to get involved in that, You can call the church office and they can tell you when and where. You can look on our new website under discipleship, under chemical dependency and alcohol dependency support, and boom, there's numbers there that you can call. So I'm going to tell you what, part of me telling this story today, I got to be honest, is a little bit selfish, because telling this and being honest and sort of ripping my shirt open and letting you see my heart, that's one of those ways that God uses to keep me sober. I'm going to leave you with one thought, and it has to do with the tragedy of 9/11. I remember the pictures, I know you do, of New York and buildings falling and people running for their lives, running away from this problem, running away from this destruction. And yet, if you look in most of those pictures, you see some people running back towards the problem. Now, I'm telling you, those first responders were running towards the problem. Alcoholism and drug addiction are a problem. They're a problem in our culture and our life. They're a problem everywhere. I want us all, as men of this church, to feel called to be that person that runs towards the problem instead of away from it. Okay? And so God, in His mercy, will give us all the strength to do that. Y'all have been a very quiet and good listening people today. I am very thankful to be here, thankful to be sober, but any day is a good day for me to be sober. Thanks.
good time up there. God will be back.